Home Broadcast Center. This is Take Two. Me, Martinez. California voters could be leaning toward trimming down 1978's historic Prop 13 and not allowing for affirmative action to make its way back into the state. We'll dive into those stories and more on our weekly politics chat, State of Affairs. Plus, if you've always wanted to be on the app TikTok, well, TikTok. Their clock in the U.S. is running out. It's all ahead on Take Two. From 89.3 KPCC and KPCC.org, this is Take Two. I'm Martinez. Thanks for joining us today. Coming up.
Internet access is not considered a public utility, so this really comes down to income.
Yet all of LA's community colleges have decided to stay mostly online through the spring. We'll talk about why in about 20 minutes. But first, it's State of Affairs, our weekly peek at politics in the Golden State. Now, many Californians love Prop 13, the way many Texans wrap their arms and guns around the Second Amendment. Come on, you know it's true. Now, in a nutshell, Prop 13 was overwhelmingly passed in 1978, and it allows for commercial and residential property tax to be reassessed when the property gets sold. Now, property owners like it because they get to keep more cash in their pocket, but schools don't like it because it's less revenue that they can get from those property taxes. Now, in the 42 years since it passed, Prop 13 has seemingly built a wall around it so steep that lawmakers who dare to take it down or even trim it do so at the risk of their political careers. So I was a bit surprised when I saw that the Public Policy Institute released results of a statewide voter survey this week, specifically on a prop that would chip away at 13. We'll get into that and more with Jack Pitney, Roy P. Crocker Professor of Politics at Claremont McKenna College, and Marisa Lagos, KQED political correspondent and co-host of the podcast Political Breakdown. All right, let's start with you, Marisa. So what would Prop 15 do, and what do Californians seem to think about it?
Well, I think what it would do is directly tied to what they think, which is it's a little confusing, right? Okay, so we're talking about changing Prop 13, the 1978 ballot measure that essentially held property rates at the level that at the assessment they were at when you bought the house or property. This wouldn't do anything to residential properties, individual owners. This is only looking to kind of change that for commercial properties. It would allow counties to reassess business properties, essentially, right? And so it would bring in, you know, billions in estimated extra taxes for the state. And what this poll showed was that it's favored, but barely. It's about 51% in favor. Not surprisingly, much more support among Democrats than Republicans. And as you said, I mean, Prop 13's long been seen as the third rail in California politics. Even the leftiest of lefties have no interest, or say they say they don't, in taking on the residential part of it. And I think that what we've seen is really a multi-year campaign over the last decade to finally get to this point of putting it before voters.
Now, Jack Pitney, I won't speak for Marisa on this, but back in 1978, I was just a lad, no cares in the world. But at the time, Prop 13 was seen as a part of a larger tax revolt movement that some say helped get Ronald Reagan to the White House. So, Jack, do the numbers that came out this week show that Californians might be loosening their grip on the untouchable Prop 13?
The answer is a firm maybe. obviously, the state has changed a lot since 1978. It's gone from being purple to deep, deep blue. Republicans used to be very competitive. Now they're irrelevant. State is a lot more liberal. So all that should speak well for the chances for Prop 15, but it's only at 51%. And if there's one thing we know about ballot measures in California is most of the time they tend to lose support during the fall. The opponents can search for messages that turn voters away from it. Messages might be mixed, they might be inconsistent, but all you need to do is create doubt in the minds of voters. So it's ahead right now, but if I were in the campaign in favor of Prop 15, I wouldn't rest easy. I'd be working very hard.
Yeah, the reason why that 51% number stood out to me is I went back to look at other PPIC polls. November 2019, it was 46%. January of the year before was 46. So 46, 46, then 51. So that to me seemed like a little bit of a leap that I didn't expect. Marisa, what do you think is influencing these PPIC numbers?
Well, I think some of it is what you alluded to at the top, A, which is just this idea that people really like, having especially their home property taxes stay at the same rate. I mean, there's a lot of people who might actually be priced out of homes if they had to pay the current rates. Now, that was the argument for Prop 13, and there's certainly a lot of people who would not be priced out and are still benefiting from this. I think there's also just the sort of typical questions that you see where there's a split between Democrats and Republicans. I thought really interestingly, younger folks were way more open to this, people who didn't weigh in on Prop 13 to begin with, like myself. People who are renters were more likely to support this change. So I think that you see there some of the kind of fear probably among homeowners that this could be a slippery slope. And I think, Jack's right. I mean, and you're right. You want, it's easier to convince people to vote no, always. And you want to be in the 60s, really, to say we feel comfortable with our lead with any ballot measure, let alone one that seeks to increase any taxes during the middle of a recession and pandemic. So I think that they definitely have their work cut out for them. And, the thing about this measure is that there's a very strong, very well-funded opposition in the business community. And I think that one of the challenges is, it's really hard to untangle exactly which businesses and owners this would impact. Both sides kind of have different takes on whether, say, agriculture would be impacted by this.
Yeah, Jack, and when it comes to Prop 13, I've always heard that the opposition is centered on, well, even if you want to take a little bit off of it, that's just your foot in the door to take the whole thing down. That's, I've always heard that argument before. But with California going through what it's going through, when you got wildfires, the pandemic, California has no money left, could that be one of the reasons why people might be softening on this?
Could very well be. And the proponents of the measure are going to say, during the pandemic, revenues have taken a hit. We have to find revenue someplace. That's why we need to pass this measure. The flip side, as Marissa pointed out, the opponents are going to say, yeah, a recession time like this is exactly the wrong time to pass a tax increase that could hurt business and thereby hobble job creation. So that's the argument you're going to be hearing.
All right. Now, another prop that jumped out at me is 16, Prop 16, which would restore affirmative action in the state. Marissa, what would 16 do? And then, with apologies to Kai Rizdahl, let's do the numbers on it. I need the music, I think. But
I'll do it. So this is an interesting one. This is, again, just so for that, word salad number soup. This would repeal Prop 209, which was a 1990s ballot measure, which I actually think more people will, remember even if they didn't vote on it, hearkening back to my earlier comments, because this was a huge fight in California. This essentially said that in government, including, and this is most importantly, public universities, you could not use somebody's race or ethnicity to decide whether that they should be let in, essentially. And while this would impact government jobs and other agencies, really the fight has centered around the UC system and the CSU system. And it's an interesting question. I mean, what we've seen in a lot of reports over the years is that, this really gets to the bigger conversation about institutional racism and systemic racism. And are people who start with a different color skin kind of starting behind the same starting line as people who might be white or wealthier, right? And so the idea of proponents say is that these university schools should have more discretion to consider those types of things, to consider the diversity of their student body or of, their employees. And the opposite side says no. This is America. It's a meritocracy. And this is going to hurt people. And I think, interestingly, and we can get into this, the Asian American community has been very outspoken in opposition to this.
Yeah, absolutely. And L.A. and San Francisco, the only places in the entire state with more than one third support for bringing back affirmative action. Now, Jack, what do you make of the lack of support to reinstate affirmative action?
Well, a couple of things are going on. Here in California, non-Hispanic whites make up only 41% of the state's adult population, but 55% of the state's likely voters. So that's a big chunk of it. But that's not all. Nationwide, if you look at the surveys on affirmative action, it's not nearly as popular as progressives would hope. There was a survey from Pew Research that found that nearly three-quarters of Americans believe that colleges shouldn't take race into account when making admissions decisions. So that's the attitude that the proponents of this measure have to grapple with and have to try to change.
And Marisa, what you were talking about earlier when it comes to resistance from Asian Americans, the Mercury News reports a very vocal resistance, particularly with Chinese American conservative immigrant families who worry about their kids getting into colleges. I'll quote one person, Saga Conroy, a 2009 Chinese immigrant. She says, "California is so diverse and we treat everyone equally, and that's for immigrants that Prop 16 does not fit into their American journey." Marisa, what she just said tracks 100% with my immigrant family, because that's how they feel about affirmative action, even though I have aunts and uncles that probably benefited from affirmative action, teachers and two LA city workers.
Right. And who on the other side have probably, you know, not everybody, but may have faced racism or other, you know, sort of economic hurdles that they might not have if they had been born here and been white. I mean, I think that's the challenge. And this is what Mark Baldessari, who conducted this poll, told us this week, is there is a sense. I mean, when this passed very overwhelmingly in the state legislature earlier this year, it was as the George Floyd protests were breaking out, as we were seeing this racial uprising. I think the challenge, because there's not a ton of actual organized opposition to this, is for the proponents to really tie this to the current moment we're in, to the Black Lives Matter movement and these conversations around systemic racism, and frame it in that context instead of kind of going back to the same fight we had in the 1990s with, you might remember Ward Connerly, who I noticed has been making the rounds again. Yeah. He was a UC Regent African-American man who really pushed 209 and is now opposing this measure.
We're talking State of Affairs with Jack Pitney and Marisa Lagos. All right, Marisa, switching gears here. You reported a story for KQED on the Prosecutors Alliance of California. Tell us about that.
Yeah, this is, as someone who's been covering criminal justice, really interesting to me. A group of four folks, three elected prosecutors and one who your LA listeners are very familiar with, George Gascon, who's challenging Jackie Lacey, have banded together to create essentially an alternative to the existing statewide District Attorneys Association. They say that they're going to use their leverage as DAs, including Tori Verver Salazar, the San Joaquin District Attorney, who is a Republican and a fiscal conservative. And they say that they want to push back on what they see as sort of an unwillingness to progress within the broader prosecutorial community, that they want to defend some of the reforms that we've seen around criminal justice in recent years, and just offer a different voice to both the electorate and lawmakers about what good criminal justice policy is in their mind. And they say that the statewide elected District Attorneys Association, who does wield a fair amount of power in Sacramento and has been very successful in lobbying lawmakers on laws they don't like or changes to sentencing laws they don't like, that this will kind of offer an alternative voice to that group.
Now, Jackie Lacey, not part of this group that Marisa reported on, but she has the support of the LAPD and the LA Sheriff's Unions, and she's been running a tough on crime platform. How does this play out, or how does that kind of platform play out in 2020? And maybe is the only thing that matters for Jackie Lacey is that it plays well enough to voters who quietly see things her way?
Yeah, I think she has a pretty strong chance because of that. After all, you hire a DA to be tough on crime. That's part of the informal job description. And she has that going for her. And a lot of this race is, you know, comes down to localism and classic ethnic politics. Gascon's problem is that he is from out of town. Not only from out of town, he's from San Francisco. And Lacey has longstanding support in the African-American community. Gascon is Hispanic. But the question is whether Mexican-Americans in Los Angeles will rally around a Cuban-American from San Francisco. We'll see in a few weeks.
Now, Marisa, there's been a lot of friction of late between lawmakers pushing for criminal justice reform and those who represent law enforcement. Tell us about another story for you this week on KQED, just a wild one that I was just shocked to read.
You know, I was too, when I saw this first on Twitter a few nights ago, I actually waited to confirm it because I didn't want to retweet something that wasn't true. But it's true. The California Correctional Peace Officers Association, this is the association, the union that represents guards in the prison system, put out a video. It was about 2.5 minutes on their website and Facebook pages where they talked about defending police against sort of attacks on law enforcement. and about, you know, encouraging people to vote. But they also included a part where they talked about targeting legislative districts. And there was actually a wall of photos. And over Reggie Jones-Sawyer, a Los Angeles area assemblyman who chairs public safety and who is also Black, they put crosshairs over his face. And they, you know, came under immediate fire, saying that this was a threat, could cause his family harm. They took it down, but defended themselves, saying nobody, you know, we were targeting him legislatively, not, you know, in an actual physically threatening manner. But it certainly caused a lot of hand-wringing.
Yeah. That's a tough argument to buy. I got to be honest with you to hear that. So, Jack, on a bigger picture level, I mean, these conflicts cannot be conducive to making policy or moving forward on anything, right? I mean, so where does this go and how could it be possibly addressed?
It's a probably the most divisive issue in the country right now. And obviously, as Marissa pointed out, one of the things you don't do in a campaign is have the imagery with the crosshairs. This is something that actually has gone back quite a while in politics. You know, it's common to use the term target this, target that. But when you have a graphical image, that sums up a lot of bad memories, particularly to those of us who remember the 1960s.
All right. One more thing before we go, turning to D.C., because yesterday the president was at the White House Conference on American History, and he went after the 1619 Project. So, Marissa, first, for those who don't know, what is the 1619 Project and what is Trump offering as an alternative?
This is a project by the New York Times that essentially seeks to sort of reframe the way we talk about American history, starting with the first ship of enslaved people that arrived from Africa in 1619 and kind of looking at our history through the frame of that slavery, of that terrible history of slavery, and how racial politics has really influenced almost everything we do in the United States. Betsy DeVos, Trump's education secretary, and the president have pushed back against this narrative, claiming that it sort of seeks to paint American and American history as bad, and instead of, you know, the sort of shining light on the hill that they see as. And they've actually threatened to try to take away money from California for teaching curriculum tied to that project. I think it's important to note that the Federal Education Department doesn't actually have any power over curriculum, but they are looking to develop something, and I think sort of ban some of these conversations within the federal government and create an alternative curriculum that folks could adopt that maybe looks at our history a little bit through more rose-colored glasses, so to speak.
Now, Jack, he said all kinds of things like it'll destroy the civic bonds that tie us together and destroy the country. Jack, I might be called a killjoy here by Trump supporters for pointing out that this subtle show of patriotism comes with an election right around the corner. But seeing as your new book that came out in April is called Un-American, The Fake Patriotism of Donald J. Trump, how does his proposal, the 1776 Commission, line up with what you wrote about in your book?
Exactly what you would expect. It's symbolism over substance. And there are a couple of problems with this. One, there really is a legit debate over how to teach American history, but Trump is the last guy in the country to lead it. This is a guy who literally thought that Frederick Douglass was still alive. Not Mr. History there. But more significantly, if conservatives believe anything, it's federalism. They believe that states and local school boards are perfectly capable of making up their own minds what to do with the history curriculum. And what conservatives would usually say in a situation like this is they don't need Washington to tell them what to do. So this is pretty inconsistent with the basic historical stance of the Republican Party.
And one note, the creator of the 1619 Project, Ida Bay Wells, mentioned in a tweet that the conference he was at does not have a single Black historian there at all. So that's a little context there. Jack Pitney, Roy P. Crocker, professor of politics at Claremont McKenna College, and Marissa Lagos, KQED political correspondent and co-host of the podcast Political Breakdown. Jack, Marissa, have a great weekend.
You too.
Thank you.
The life of a community college student can be a bit of a struggle. In LA, the district serves a higher percentage of low-income students than any of the other higher learning options out there. Now, they've decided to go mostly online through the spring, so that means enrollment took a hit. And for these students, find out why they probably won't make it back. Find out when Take 2 continues in 60 seconds. Stay with us.
Don't you think that it's boring how people talk? Making smart with the words again. Well, I'm bored. Because I'm doing this for the thrill of it, killing it, never not chasing a million things I want. I am only as young as the minute is, full of it, getting pumped up on the little bright things I want.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and streaming on the KPCC app. I'm Amy Martinez. Earlier this week, the Los Angeles Community College District announced it would remain majority online only in the spring. Now, there will be a few exceptions, classes for nurses and mechanics, for example, where hands-on learning is essential. But it's a big move for one of the largest community college districts in the nation. 9 colleges, hundreds of thousands of students, many of whom come from lower-income households that may lack a reliable internet access or devices. For more on what this means, we have LA's district chancellor, Francisco Rodriguez. Chancellor, what made you make this decision to continue school mostly online through the spring?
First of all, thank you for the invitation to join you. The decision to continue primarily and remotely online for the spring was one where health and safety were and continue to be the predominant factors in our decision making. As we looked at it, the science is simply not there to return safely, and meaning that there is no vaccine, and the provisions that have to be involved with returning, we simply can't do at the moment. So we need to understand that amongst our students, our staff and faculty, there's still a real legitimate fear of the community spread of COVID-19. So our decision derives from very close consultation with our county public health department, who's been doing an excellent job, discussions with our internal leadership here, and frankly, with my colleagues at other local community colleges. So moving forward, planning is certainly important in this time of just uncertainty. We don't want to waffle on the decision. Our students deserve to know sooner than later. Our families need to plan and prepare. Our faculty need to plan their curriculum. So for us, similar to our summer session and how we call this fall, we thought it was prudent to move forward with making sure that both our winter session, which begins on January the 4th, and our spring semester, which begins in February, we let folks know that we're going to remain primarily online and through remote learning.
Now, what was the thinking behind holding in-person classes for nurses and mechanics? And how will the district navigate that, given that maybe the work could mean being more hands-on or getting within that 6 feet radius?
Well, we are authorized by the state of California for what's called essential infrastructure. And these are the classes that will help our economy keep strong and our society functioning. So in our particular case, for community colleges, we have welding and utility lineman program. We have 7 schools of nursing, aviation mechanics, and pharmacy technologists. So for us, we are authorized. And so we're doing that with all the health and safety precautions that are needed, are necessary to keep our faculty, staff who support the faculty, and importantly, our students safe.
Now, we've heard a lot about the challenges students of all ages face around technology and internet access, or just finding a quiet spot to do some work. Chancellor, do you have a sense of how many students in attending LA community colleges face these obstacles?
We do. We've run multiple surveys, and not uncommon to other community colleges, we have thousands of students that need Chromebooks and other Surface Go devices and access to technology and the internet. We've estimated about 30,000 students in our student body don't have access right now or reliable access to technology or technology tools. So for that reason, over the last several months, we've distributed about 17,000 devices at no cost to students. And we have plans and ordered another 15,000. And we're distributing them just as fast as we can get them. We're trying to alleviate as much as we can the necessity, because if you don't have technology and equipment, you're going to be disconnected and you're going to be farther out. Unfortunately, internet access is not considered a public utility. So this really comes down to income, and the lower income families are harder hit with not having access to technology tools or to reliable internet access, which makes them less likely to succeed in the environment that we're providing.
We're talking to the chancellor of the Los Angeles Community College District, Francisco Rodriguez. Chancellor, there are some students in your district that are experiencing homelessness or food insecurity. Now, we know the board just approved a program to provide some beds and services. How will that work?
We have two new pilot programs for students who are homeless and need shelter. And one is with the LA Room and Board, the Opportunity House that is available through that agency. The other is through the Shower of Hope. There are more than 50 rooms available. On our website, we have the application process. If you find yourself homeless and in need of a room and are a student at the LA Community College District, please look that up.
You know, we read that the program provides only about 35 beds. Chancellor, what are the options for all the other students who experience some of these things, homelessness and food insecurity?
Well, at this point, that is the number of beds that are available. They are looking to expand both the Shower of Hope and then ultimately with support, LA Room and Board can also expand to other sites. So we're hopeful that as their ability to expand accelerates, we'll be able to provide students who are in dire need of this kind of support.
And over the last few months, Chancellor, I've spoken to educators at different levels, so the high school level, elementary school, and also universities, but I have not spoken to any educators at the community college level to ask how they're doing in terms of remote learning. So what are you hearing from your faculty and staff in terms of those challenges?
It's been a tremendous challenge. We pivoted in March, and in our particular case, transitioned 10,000 courses that we had available on our books for the spring semester to remote learning. And that was a tremendous, over 2-week period, faculty training, professional development, innovation took over, and we were able to pivot and maintain our academic continuity. So it's been a hard go. It's not good for everyone. Not all students like this environment. Some students would rather have and are waiting for the person-to-person interaction. But right now, because of the safety and health concerns of our students and our faculty and staff, this is the way that we have to go. So it's been a big lift, but one that we have responded to and are very proud of.
When you said that some students are waiting for that personal one-on-one interaction, does that mean that enrollment has gone down because of the pandemic and because of the remote learning?
It has. Because community colleges serve the highest proportion of students who are low income, really the pandemic has hit low income students and students of color harder than any other student populations. Students from families with incomes under $75,000 are nearly twice as likely to say that they've canceled all their plans or not going to college this year as compared to students from families with incomes over $100,000. And we at LACCD, we have 52% of our students who live in poverty. So this has clearly hit students in poverty in a much, much harder way. So we've been able to hang on to about 90% of our students compared to last fall. We're very proud of that. There's more that we can do, however, to make sure that we keep those students as they navigate this pandemic. So although the modality has changed for our classes, I'd like to say that the quality and the connection of our faculty to students that remains the same.
You know, the things, though, Chancellor, that I know about community college students is that they're a little bit different than the typical 18-year-old college freshman at, say, USC or at a private school. It's just their life is different that brought them to a community college. Their circumstances are a lot different. But I also know, going back to my own experience, that if a community college student decides to not go to class for a semester, it is very difficult to get them back on campus. How worried are you that the students you've lost, you might not get back?
I am. I have to be worried and I am concerned. And that's why our colleges are absolutely getting after it by calling students personally. And there are students who actually submit the application but never enroll. So we're calling them, encouraging them to come in, having very personalized the connections and trying to, again, expound on the benefits of attaining a higher education at this time. Because you are correct. When students leave, particularly lower income students, they are less likely to return.
What would it take for your students to return in person?
Well, several things. First, we'd have to have some very clear direction, support, and guidance from our county public health department to do that. So that's the first thing. And I suspect that that would be influenced by the availability of a vaccine or something that keeps us safe and limits the community spread. I expect this to be a phased-in approach as the number of cases go down, as the number of deaths go down in Los Angeles, as we begin to contain and see the numbers go to very safe and acceptable levels. I think you'll see of higher education reopening in a way that is a safe for everyone.
That's Los Angeles Community College District Chancellor Francisco Rodriguez. Chancellor, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, A.
In addition to LA, Glendale and San Bernardino Community College districts have announced that they, too, will mostly remote learn in the spring. Now, have you been seeing all these funny, silly, short videos all over the internet and wondered, where are they coming from? Well, it's more likely than not that you're watching a video from the app TikTok. Yeah, TikTok, ring a bell. But if you've also thought, well, I'm going to get on TikTok soon. Well, TikTok, their clock in the U.S. is about to run out. Find out why when TikTok continues. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app. I'm Amy Martinez. Today, the Trump administration ordered a ban on the Chinese-owned apps WeChat and TikTok. Now, starting Sunday at midnight, neither will be available on app stores for people living here in the U.S. If they've already been installed on your phones, they will not be deleted. However, the government has ordered all American companies to stop transactions and internet traffic through WeChat on Sunday, and a similar rule will affect TikTok in mid-November unless a deal is reached. The government cites national security concerns as the reason, but this move would have big effects on LA, where many different communities rely on both apps to either talk with their loved ones or to make it big. Joining us to discuss is Karen North, director of the Annenberg Program on Online Communities at USC. Karen, so let's start with WeChat, which is especially big in Chinese and Chinese American communities. Can you tell us a little bit about how and why it's used by people here?
I mean, you know, one of the biggest, it's a very robust, mostly texting, chatting feature that people install on their phones. So much like texting each other, it's, you know, amazingly popular, especially among Chinese populations, but also among others. Around the world, people look for free texting, free chatting opportunities, and this is one of the better user experiences.
So it keeps people connected across the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now, okay, what about TikTok? That's the app for making the short videos. That's become a major platform for people looking to become influencers, especially right here in influencer capital of the world, Los Angeles. Can you describe the cottage industry set up for TikTok creators here?
Well, so it's a really interesting and very, like, complicated thing to discuss. But the bottom line is that, you know, all these little fun videos, especially the little fun videos that involve silly dances or, you know, amazing, integrations with music, a lot of those things are coming out of TikTok. And TikTok was engineered brilliantly to help people connect with music, to do fun little videos, and to share. And also, most of us believe that it was built, you know, in a sort of amazing way to collect data on the people who use the app, which is where not just the Trump administration, but for a long time now, people have been concerned about the data collection from that particular app.
And if you're someone that has any kind of personality and a little bit of talent, you can make a career out of being on TikTok.
Yeah, so it's the same thing that we see on, you know, the YouTube influencers or the Instagram influencers. It's the same idea where people develop a following and they have their own little shows or their own, sort of content that they put up, and people follow them and engage with them. And then, of course, advertisers and other individuals will pay them money to have them promote, for example, products. And TikTok is particularly good at creating a buzz around people and creating a following for people who are, you know, who have that certain special something.
Yeah, TikTokers have moved here to mansions here in L.A. in the Hollywood Hills, and they have agents and managers, that the whole thing. They're like stars, but on TikTok. Now, why does the Trump administration consider these apps a national security concern?
So I have to say that, like, you know, it's a valid concern, okay? It's a valid concern regardless of politics. So if you depoliticize this, you know, my warning to people is that whenever you download an app from another country, then that app or that business is being governed by the laws of the other country, not of our country. So we have, you know, a lot of rights, individual rights and rights to privacy here in the United States, and they are very, very different and not as solid in China. So TikTok, as it is governed by Chinese law, is allowed to and sometimes, you know, potentially mandated to collect data and share it with, for example, the Chinese government. And so, you know, as Americans who really are concerned about individual privacy protections, we've been, you know, there are a lot of stories on the news about the way that China has surveillance and the way China collects data.
Yeah.
And those are valid concerns because the laws are different there. Just like the laws are even more protective in Europe than they are in the United States, they are more in favor of collecting and sharing data in China.
Now, last month, WeChat users got together to sue the Trump administration for violating their First Amendment rights in banning the use of the app. What sort of power would a lawsuit like this have?
So two things. One, I'm not a lawyer, so I'm, okay. You know, let me just give you my opinion on this, but it's not a legal opinion. But I always want to remind people that when you think about First Amendment rights, you do not have a First Amendment right, for example, to free speech if you walk into my living room. I can come up with ridiculous rules and kick you out for saying whatever I want. The same thing, think about a private club with a dress code, okay? And, you know, think about a business. So these are private businesses, and they can have their own rules. And we don't necessarily have First Amendment rights in somebody's business, in the community that they've established, and certainly not if we are standing in a business that is actually in China. Then we have the ramifications of their laws, not our laws.
Okay. Now, if WeChat is disabled permanently here, Karen, what alternatives do families have who rely on the app for connecting with the people they love here or overseas?
It's a very interesting question. I mean, keep in mind that people, especially Americans, but people in general are very fickle when it comes to what kinds of digital experiences they gravitate to or what kinds of entertainment they like. So let me just use TikTok as a metaphor. We're already seeing a ton of these very, very well-known, very well-compensated TikTok influencers jumping over to Reels, which is the equivalent new app that was created by Instagram, and Triller, which has been around for a while. So people are like, you know, if I can't do it on TikTok, there are other playgrounds, okay? And WeChat is, you know, a lot of things in China are built on this business called Tencent. And so that is Tencent's chat function. And so if you're in China, it's a little bit complicated because there are fewer opportunities. But you have to assume that for Chinese people in America who are trying to stay connected with their Chinese friends and family, that they will find another platform to use. For Americans, we will just definitely find another platform to use.
All right, that's Karen North, director of the Annenberg Program on Online Communities at USC. Karen, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me back.
All right, used to be if you said out loud that you believe in UFOs and aliens and little green men visiting the Earth, you'd be dismissed, laughed at, kind of just dismissed as some kind of kook. Today, it's actually way more in the mainstream, so much so that the U.S. government has even admitted that they've been on the lookout for UFOs as well. Coming up, a podcast all about UFOs, why we obsess over them, and why we just don't want to be alone in this big, awful universe. That's coming up when Take Two continues in 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app. I'm E. Martinez. I love that theme song. For generations, humans have wondered if we're alone in the universe, and we've concocted many a story around the idea that we are not. The X-Files, as you hear there, Star Trek, Lost in Space. Sure, there are the conspiracy theories fueled by the mysteries about places like Era 51, but for many scientists, the hunt for extraterrestrial life is real. Now, the question is, how do they find it? And does it look like a human, an animal, or something completely different? Well, that quest is at the heart of the new season of Wild Thing, a podcast about weird things in life that capture our imaginations. It's out now, and with us to talk about it is host Laura Kranz. Hi, Laura.
Thank you. I'm excited to be back here.
Excited to have you back. Now, last season, you were hunting for Bigfoot. This season, you look to the skies. Why this new topic?
First off, when I was doing the research on the Bigfoot story, there were two big events that happened. And one was this object, Oumuamua, which passed through our solar system and then shot right back out again. And we almost missed seeing it if it weren't for some good, sharp, eagle-eyed people at one of the observatories in Hawaii. We probably wouldn't have even noticed that it had come through. And this object was an interstellar object, and they knew this because of its trajectory, of how fast it was moving, and a lot of people wondered exactly what it was. Was it a comet? Was it an asteroid? It didn't have sort of the usual movements of one of those objects. And then there was also a scientist at Harvard University who hypothesized that maybe we should consider the idea that it could be of alien origin, that it might be an alien light sail.
Yeah, there were some signs, right, Laura? I mean, there were some signs that it could have kind of its independent travel. It didn't have a bound orbit, right?
Right. Didn't have a bound orbit, which that just basically means that it's not bound to the gravity of our sun, which you wouldn't expect from an interstellar object. But what they also noticed was that it was moving in a way. It was just, you know, they would predict how it would move, and then it would slightly go off that trajectory just a little bit. And they couldn't figure out why. They didn't have enough time to study it and get all that information. So part of that unusual movement could have been, well, maybe it's being moved by something other than the laws of nature.
But that's one of the questions, though, right? Because, I mean, is it technological? Is it geological? You know, that, and that's one of the questions of when an object moves like that. It's like, what exactly is propelling it?
Right. And since we didn't, it was so far out there and it was so far away from us, all we could do was sort of see how it was moving based on photos that these giant telescopes we have were taking, and see how the light was changing on it and see sort of the speed and the trajectory and how it moved end over end. But then it would shift a little bit and people were like, huh, I wonder what is going on with this? And we just didn't have the time to study it and get the evidence or the information we need to really cement an idea of what it is. Now, most scientists, again, thought it was probably a comet, an interstellar object that had been kicked out of its own solar system or its own star system by some sort of violent eruption there were a lot of hypotheses that were put out. But then, like I said, there was this hypothesis that it was an alien star, an alien spacecraft. And this debate was happening all over the place. This wasn't just sort of on the fringes. And then you couple that with, like, 3 weeks later, there's all these articles about the Pentagon's secret UFO program.
Yeah.
The Pentagon ran this program from 2007 to 2012 with what they call black money, which is essentially money that has not been specifically designated somewhere in the budget. And they were supposedly looking at unidentified aerial phenomena, which is the military's term for UFO, so that they'll be taken a little more seriously.
We're talking to Laura Kranz, host of the new podcast, Wild Thing, actually season two of the podcast called Wild Thing. And this season, it's all about the search for extraterrestrial life. Do you think, Laura, that Hollywood has done a poor job? You mentioned the fact that life doesn't have to be little green men, as Hollywood has sold to us over the years. Do you think Hollywood has done a disservice when it comes to our imagination of what life outside of Earth could be like?
Well, you know, Hollywood has kind of run into a little bit of a problem, I think, up until recent years, where they sort of had to have a guy in a suit or a woman in a suit or somebody in a suit to go and act out the part, even if it was against a green screen. So that kind of limits what your aliens might look like. Let's take Star Trek, for example. Like, Spock, the only thing that makes him alien is he's got sort of a bowl haircut and he's got pointy ears. And I would like to think that the universe could come up with something more diverse than that, especially since, like, on our planet alone, there's all kinds of different forms and shapes and creations and examples of life. And then the best thing we can do for the planet Vulcan is guys with pointy ears. I feel like we could have done a little bit better with that. But I also understand the limitations of budget and actors. Actually, so I was in a conversation with astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson, and he said that one of his favorite aliens is the blob because it is not similar to humans or vertebrate life here on Earth. It doesn't have a face. It doesn't have arms and legs. It just is sort of like this oozing mass.
Now, the issues that we've talked about, they come up in the first episode. What are we going to hear the rest of the season?
So we're going to talk to SETI scientists. This is the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. These are people like Jill Tarter and Frank Drake who pioneered this search. And they're looking for intelligent extraterrestrial life that might have the kind of technology that would put out a signal that we could find. I also talked to astrobiologists who are really looking for, they're more on the microbial side of things, or they're looking for the biochemical and chemical precursors to life that might explain first how life formed on our planet here on Earth, and then might help us discover or understand better how life might form on other planets and what to look for as we're sending out these amazingly powerful telescopes and technology out into space. I took a trip to the Roswell UFO Festival in July of last year and talked to the people who think that, yes, in 1947, a craft or something crashed into the desert and that the government has been covering it up ever since. Spend some time talking about the Pentagon's UFO program. And then I kind of take a turn and we look a little bit at the philosophy and the more spiritual side of this fascination with aliens and why it is that we want so badly for something else to be out there.
So let me ask you about that real quick, Laura, because that's one of the things when it comes to this topic, when it comes to UFOs, extraterrestrials, life on other planets or life in the universe, it almost feels like a religion. Like when they're talking, it's as if they're talking about an experience that they are talking about when it comes to faith, faith in the experience that they had. Either they saw something or they believe something. I mean, that's where this is right now. Short of having evidence, right, Laura, it is an exercise in faith.
Yeah, there definitely is an element to that. And in one of the episodes, I sort of talk about how, especially as religion has become less of a central point in people's lives, they may have replaced the idea of God or religion with extraterrestrials. There's also this sense that extraterrestrials, if they do exist and are able to communicate with us and reach out to us, that they would probably be an older civilization than what we are, because we as a planet and as a solar system are on the younger end of things in terms of our galaxy. So maybe they would be able to offer advice as to how to get through some of the crises that we face, like climate change or, you know, the potential of an asteroid hitting us. They might provide a way through or an example for us to follow if we want to sort of continue to exist as a civilization. So I think that that idea exists in this as well.
So, Laura, ultimately, why do you think that human beings, that we almost need or require to know if we're alone in the universe? I mean, it's funny because people fight loneliness all the time, especially in this pandemic. But as a collective billion species on this planet, I think we always want to know, is there anything else?
Yeah, I think we want to know. And I think at the same time, we also kind of know that we may not ever get the answer to that. So I think what this is more about is about curiosity. And this is sort of at the heart of who we are as humans, as who we are as a species, in that we've always sort of, we wanted to know more about the world. And once we started to look beyond the world, we wanted to know more about the solar system, and we wanted to know more about the galaxy and the universe. And it's just sort of this unending quest for knowledge and a desire to know things that might not have a definite answer.
Laura Krantz is the host of the podcast Wild Things. Season 2 is out now. Get it wherever you get your podcast. Laura, thanks a lot.
Thank you, A.
All right, finally back here on Earth. Here's our favorite picks on what to do this weekend to give your mind a break.
I'm KPCC's Leo Duran, and A. Martinez, the skies are starting to sort of clear up, but the air is a little rough out there in certain areas. But fear not, there's still a good mix of events both inside and outside your home to do this weekend.
All right, so what's up first for those who still want to wait out the air quality a little bit and stay at home?
Well, today and tomorrow, enjoy the iHeartRadio Music Fest from your couch. Starting today at 6 p.m., this fest streams acts like BTS, Coldplay, Keith Urban, Usher, and more. I'll be blunt, I always like the idea of music fests until I think about being under the sun probably all day, using porta-potties, etc. So this is how you can have your fest experience from the comfort of your own home. It's all through the CW network, so you can find it available on the air, on its app, and on its website. And when you want to enjoy, it's free.
Okay, then what are some things to do for people who have been cooped up the past week and feel like, okay, things are okay enough for me to go venture out?
Right, so one thing you can do is shake out your pent-up legs tomorrow night in Torrance for Summer Swing Nights. It's a drive-in concert with a big band jazz act performing. It's called The Swing Tones and The Swing Tonettes. Music will be performed live on stage with big screens so you can see all the action, and also the sounds will be pumped through your own car stereo too so you can hear it well wherever you are. There'll also be food trucks on site, so, you know, here's an idea. You can make it a date night. Tickets per car start at $50.
All right, finally, what's out there, Leo, for people who have been craving some nature?
So, disclaimer first, I know you have a fear of a certain bug, so you may want to close your ears for the next 30 seconds.
Oh, no.
But today, after a delay because of the wildfires, the Natural History Museum reopens its Butterfly Pavilion in outdoor gardens.
Nope.
Yeah, I know. For people who do like butterflies, you'll be able to stroll the grounds and take in the wildlife, and do it physically distanced since there will be reservations on time tickets for entry. And when you go, it's $6 per admission. Now, there are a bunch of events to go to, with and without butterflies, eh? Find out what you could do this weekend by heading to our site, laist.com. That's laist.com. And you can follow me on Twitter, at Leo Has a Cat.
I'm not ashamed of my fear of butterflies. I'm just embarrassed by it. That's KPCC's Leo Duran. Leo, thanks a lot.
Thanks, eh? And I know.
All right, if you missed any part of Take 2 today, yesterday, the day before, just head to wherever you get your podcast. There we will be waiting to be heard by you. We're also on Twitter at Take 2. That's at Take 2. I'm there as well at A. Martinez LA. That's at A. Martinez LA. And that's good for Twitter and Instagram for your social media convenience. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take 2 is back Monday at 2. Talk to you then.